From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Melissa Block, and this is On Point.
We vote next! We vote next! We vote next! We vote next!
Those are young people chanting at San Francisco's March for Our Lives rally against gun violence last month, letting the adults know they plan to take their march all the way to the polls. There's been a tidal wave of youth activism after February's mass school shooting in Parkland, Florida. And many are asking whether that will lead to a wave of youth voting in this year's midterm elections. The youth vote. It's a coveted block for campaigns, but historically, young people have not showed up in force on Election Day. Meanwhile, a handful of municipalities have lowered the voting age to 16 for local elections, and a Washington, D.C. city councilman wants to make it legal for 16-year-olds to vote for president in the district. This hour on Point, American teens are marching. Are they registering to vote, too? You can join us on air or online. Will youth activists become the next powerful voting bloc? 18-year-olds or soon-to-be 18-year-olds, we want to hear from you. Are you registering? If not, why not? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining me now from Littleton, Colorado is Sam Craig. He's a 15-year-old sophomore at Chatfield Senior High, and he's a student organizer and executive director of Vote for Our Lives. That's a series of rallies that will kick off tomorrow, encouraging young people to register to vote. Sam, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Melissa. Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. And I guess we're catching you before you head into school.
Yes. Yeah, right before.
Okay, great. Also joining me from Vernon, New Jersey is Andy Bernstein. He's the executive director of Headcount. That's an organization that registers youth voters at concerts and most recently at last month's March for Our Lives in Washington. Andy, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
And Sam, let's start with you there in Colorado. Why did you start getting involved with this plan? What's your goal with Vote for Our Lives?
So Vote for Our Lives started right after the march. I organized the march here in Denver, and just about 3 days after that, I started thinking, okay, what's next? How are we going to translate this to some real action and some real change? And we have been running with and talking all about the youth vote and voting in general. A lot of the marches, all of the chants were focused on voting them out, and it was an inspiring thing to hear, and it's been inspiring to see how many of my friends and how many youth in general are getting registered and getting active and engaged, specifically now that we feel so affected by gun violence, by this issue in particular. We are starting to make our voices heard and go out and make a difference, and I wanted to make it as easy as possible and as fun as possible for people to get registered to vote. And I think it really falls in line with Andy's message as well. We've been working together a little bit in the past couple of days here, and I think both of our goal is just to provide an easy place where people can get registered to vote. The rallies, Vote for Our Lives, that we're going to have over the next 6 months until midterms are all going to be focused on voter registration. Tomorrow here in Littleton, we're bringing in a bunch of student survivors and adult survivors of gun violence. We're flying out about 60 Parkland students. We have Columbine survivors, and it's just going to be a really incredible time for everybody to share their story. And then we will finish out the night with a guest performance from Isaac Slade, the lead singer of The Fray, and his wife Anna. And then at the end of the night, a vigil to honor the victims of Columbine.
Yeah, we should mention that the timing of this is no accident. You're coming up on the 19th anniversary of the Columbine shooting.
Yeah, it's very timely, and it's very hard for our community. I, of course, go to Chatfield, not Columbine, but even at my school, I feel the mood of this month is dampening, and it's hard, and a lot of my teachers are survivors, and I know a lot of survivors in the community, and this is just a very difficult time for them, and that makes it very timely, and with all of this going on, it just seems like it hasn't stopped from the shooting at Parkland on the 14th, and then the walkouts and the marches, and now we're coming up on the 19th anniversary, and we're celebrating it and remembering it with this rally and moving forward, and how, when we do move forward and we come into the elections this November, how can we make a difference and make sure it doesn't happen again?
And Sam, I'm curious, when you approach people in your age group about registering to vote, those who would be eligible to vote in November, what kind of response are you getting? Are people engaged, or are you also having to change some minds, convince folks that they need to do that?
Yeah, it's a good mix. I'd say more than ever, I have seen people getting registered to vote. I was trying to find one of my friends that wasn't registered so that I could get them registered as kind of our kickoff and have our first person registered to vote to start our movement. And it took a couple phone calls to find one of my friends that wasn't pre-registered or registered. So it was really awesome for me to see that we are getting out there. A lot of them have told me that at the walkout that I organized at my school, they got registered then or they got registered at the marches. And so I think that people are getting engaged now more than ever since we feel that we are kind of at the front line of this issue and we feel so affected by this issue that we're finally kind of standing up and taking this issue into our own hands and and using our democratic right and exercising that right to make sure that we are protected and that the people that work for us will also listen to us.
Sam, stay with us, and Andy Bernstein, I'm going to come to you in just a second. But first, I want to take a quick call from Nashville, Tennessee. Jenna is calling, and I'm glad to hear that young people are listening and are calling in. Jenna, you're on the air.
Hi, Melissa.
Hey.
My personal belief is that we, as my age group, I'm 19, and, you know, as the new college group is coming in, I feel that we are going to be the big change that's coming to America. We now more than ever are fighting for equal rights. We're fighting for gun control. We're fighting for as much as we can to change this instilled hatred that's in America. And I feel our president is causing this hatred that we are battling. And I see a lot of my friends voting and registering to vote because we want to see a difference.
Okay. Jenna, thank you so much for your call. And let me turn now to Andy Bernstein with Headcount, the group that registers youth voters at concerts. Andy, I'm curious, when you listen to a caller like Jenna or you listen to Sam there in Colorado, does youth voting by definition skew Democratic and liberal?
Well, certainly the statistics will bear that out, that it's not monolithic, but young voters tend to vote more Democratic than older voters, and that's one reason that you'll see certain interests going after the youth vote and trying to harness that. But really a criticism of the Democratic Party has been they haven't gone after the youth vote hard enough, that it's a constituency that is supportive but hasn't been fully energized or engaged. And I think when people look at the last presidential race, many would say that the Clinton campaign really just didn't do enough and didn't make the young voters a priority and ended up paying a price for that.
And we'll continue talking this hour about turnout numbers and what the data show. But it is, as we mentioned earlier, a fact that the youth vote does not come out in the numbers. And if you look at demographically, with every age group, participation increases. The youth voters have not been there in the numbers that they should be if you look at registration.
Yeah, and that's been true for a long time. And as people get older, they get more engaged in the process. And that's not a new phenomenon. What I think is a new phenomenon is that you really have the youngest generation kind of leading a cultural movement right now. And we're not even talking about millennials. We're talking about post-millennials. And while maybe the generation before them didn't come out in big numbers, that's this new generation, there's no history yet. This is the first time they're eligible to vote. So the Parkland voter, the voices that you're hearing on this show today are potentially really leading a youth movement that could have some real political differences with kids who are just a few years older than them.
So you see a difference here. Sam, when you talk to your fellow students, and especially as young as you are, you're a sophomore, what are you hearing? Does it line up with what you've been hearing so far?
Yeah. It's like I said before, we're definitely getting more people registered to vote than I think I've ever seen before. And I'm not even old enough in Colorado to pre-register to vote, but I will be soon, just 14 days from now. So it's getting close, and it's exciting for me. It's something that is easy and something that I am excited to be a part of, something that I'm excited to be able to do and to make my voice heard in this way. And even though I can't register to vote and even though I won't be able to vote until I'm 18, There's still so much I can do to make a difference that I am just pushing myself out there as much as I can and encouraging everybody else to do the same and get registered to vote. And I'm just pushing that message as hard as I can because I think that it is so important. We say a lot of things. We want to see a lot of things done. But if we don't vote, they're not going to get done.
I want to try to squeeze. I'm sorry. I want to squeeze in another call before we go to the break. Caleb calling from Murfreesboro, Tennessee. Caleb, you're on Point.
How you doing?
Great. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm a 20-year-old. I go to college. I just wanted to comment on the fact that, you know, I don't think it's just voting. I think it's being aware. Because I know when you talk to these millennials and they go out to vote, they're more centered on the president when, in fact, local elections and state elections are just as important.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah, Caleb, it raises a good point. I mean, Andy Bernstein, we are headed toward a midterm when turnout across the board is lower than for presidential elections.
Yeah, and midterms are a great opportunity on a lot of levels. For one thing, historically, control of Congress has often switched during the midterm elections. But the other thing that's where there's a lot of upside is young people have not come out for midterms. It's less than 20% of voters under 30. Whereas for the presidential elections, it hovers around 45%, 46%. So you've got more than half of young voters coming out for the presidential, to Caleb's point, and not coming out for the midterm,
yeah,
where potentially the vote has more impact. And that's what everybody's looking at. Is this the year that changes? There's so much upside. Does the Parkland movement create a change that no one's been able to create before? And there's a lot of optimism that this new set of young voters are going to come out in numbers that are very different than people who are just even a little bit older than they are.
Got it. Andy Bernstein, we have to leave it there. Andy Bernstein, Executive Director of Headcount, an organization that registers youth voters at concerts. Andy, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
And Sam Craig, a sophomore at Chatfield Senior High in Littleton, Colorado. He's a student organizer. Sam, we're going to let you get to school. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
We are discussing youth activists making their voices heard on the issues and whether or not they will register to vote. You can join the conversation. Why do you think young voters stay on the sidelines during elections? Is this time different? I'm Melissa Block, and this is On Point. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dell Technologies. Can technology reduce healthcare costs? What will it take to personalize the education of every student? And where does the media go from here? Find these answers and more on Trailblazers, a podcast hosted by best-selling author Walter Isaacson and joined by extraordinary guests who share their stories, insights, and the lessons they learned while transforming entire industries. Stream Trailblazers in your favorite podcast app or at delltechnologies.com/trailblazers.
Hi, I'm Mindy Thomas from NPR's Wow in the World, and this week it's all about Operation Earth, how to be cool to a planet that's getting hot. Check it out with the curious and conscientious kids in your life. Find Wow in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Melissa Block. We are talking about youth voter participation and youth activism. You can join the conversation. Will the teens that have been marching in the streets head to the polls for this year's midterm elections? Can they affect real political change? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And let's listen to a voice from last month's March for Our Lives in Washington, D.C. This is Parkland survivor Cameron Caskey issuing a warning to politicians.
Politicians, either represent the people or get out. The people demand a law banning the sale of assault weapons. The people demand we prohibit the sale of high-capacity magazines. The people demand universal background checks. Stand for us or beware. The voters are coming.
That voice, Cameron Caskey, at the March for Our Lives in Washington last month. Well, let's talk about some of those issues. Joining me now from New York City is John Della Volpe. He's the director of polling at the Harvard Kennedy School's Institute of Politics, where he's led polling to understand American youth voting since 2000. John, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Melissa. It's great to be with you.
And joining me from Lexington, Kentucky is Joshua Douglas. He's a law professor at the University of Kentucky, and he has extensively studied youth voter participation as well. Josh, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
And John, let me turn to you first. When you think about patterns and understanding how American youth vote or don't vote, what do you see?
Over the course of the last 20 years, we've seen a significant kind of increase one time in the number of young people who voted, and that was kind of pre and post 2001, 9/11. And what I think now, Melissa, is we're seeing a once-in-a-generation attitudinal shift about interest in voting, specifically driven by the efficacy of political engagement. What I mean by that is one of the most significant drivers of whether or not a young person votes or doesn't vote is the degree to which they think their vote matters, the degree to which they think their vote will make a tangible difference in the outcome of specific issues. And that was obviously the case after 2001 and September 11th in terms of, you know, right and wrong, life or death in war. And we're seeing the same thing happening now post the 2016 election. We see 14 to 15 point attitudinal shifts, which I think will likely drive increase in political participation among millennials and post-millennials, these 18 to 24-year-olds, in a way in which we haven't seen since 2010, likely since 2002, 2004 midterms.
Joshua Douglas, what do you think about that? I mean, do you see a different driver this time around than we've seen before?
Well, I think certainly youth are demonstrating how they're driving the movement right now. And this is not really something new. I mean, we think about the Vietnam protest that was largely youth-driven, and that led to lowering the voting age from 21 to 18. So this is not necessarily a new phenomenon that youth are driving the conversation. And I do think that we're at a new moment, which is very interesting and very intriguing.
Well, it's interesting. You mentioned the 26th Amendment when the voting age was lowered from 21 to 18. It passed through the states very quickly in just a matter of months. President Nixon at the White House signing ceremony, signing it into law, said, "The reason that I believe your generation, the 11 million new voters, will do so much for America at home is that you will infuse into this nation some idealism, some courage, some stamina, some high moral purpose that this country always needs." But I believe, Joshua Douglas, that after that there was a brief spike in youth voter participation, but it didn't last.
That's right. There was a brief spike as a sort of the novelty of being able to vote at a lower voting age took off, and that wasn't sustained. And I think there's some systemic reasons for that. You know, 18 is a odd time to begin the habit of voting, and one of the biggest predictors of whether someone will vote is if they voted previously. Voting is habit forming. And what we found is that 18 is a difficult age in which to start the habit because people are moving out of their homes. They're entering the workforce. They're going to college. So we're expecting them to jump through all of these life changes while also dealing with the logistics of registering to vote, requesting an absentee ballot in time, making sure they fill it out in time, sending it back. With all these other changes happening, I think there's a combination of reasons why 18 to 21-year-olds don't vote at large numbers. Certainly voter apathy is another one. But there are systemic barriers as well.
And to that point, we have a call from Nashville, Tennessee. Wes is on the line. Wes, what do you have to say?
Hi, Melissa. Yes, this is exactly right. The real question for me is not if students vote, but how can they vote? Because it's more difficult for them. Many of these young voters will be attending college this fall, some hundreds of miles from home. Many conservative legislatures have limited voting for students to their home precincts, which makes it nearly impossible to vote. If you have class on Tuesday, are you going to vote hundreds of miles away Tuesday night? I think it's no coincidence that many of these same states with gun laws that students want to change are the same states that passed new student voting restrictions.
John Della Volpe, what do you make of Wes's point there and restrictions or hurdles put in the place of youth who may want to vote but aren't in the right place at the right time?
I think that's certainly a factor. I think there are essentially two factors happening that kind of drive the degree to which young people vote, one of which is the attitudinal factor that I mentioned earlier in terms of the tangible nature and importance of voting, one. The second is more of a kind of a mechanical barrier. And as the caller said, it is not easy necessarily, especially if you live on a college campus, although not only about a quarter or so of the quote-unquote youth vote live and are engaged on a college campus, to make sure that the voter registration deadlines are understood, absentee ballots are mailed, that you get the mail, those sorts of things. So there are mechanical barriers, and there's been a lot of work, especially in the last decade post 9/11, led by Andy and many other organizations like Andy's, to make that system easier. We see now New Jersey is the latest state to create automatic registration. I think it's a 13th state now that has automatic registration, which is you're eligible to vote when you receive or renew your driver's license. And that was the case in Oregon, I think, which is one of the most important reasons that we saw an increase in voter participation in the last presidential elections. So I think there's a lot of great things happening, but it needs to be kind of a two-way street. Organizations need to make the process easier, but elected officials and candidates also need to kind of empower people and let them know why their vote matters. The thing I will also want to mention, Melissa, is that young people may be apathetic oftentimes about voting. It doesn't mean they're apathetic about the country. Oftentimes, especially in the midterm election, you'll find more young people volunteer in their community to make their community and their country better than actually vote. So they're not apathetic about the country, just about voting sometimes.
You know, I'm thinking about the debate in the Florida legislature after the Parkland shooting when they were considering gun reform measures. And one of the Republican state representatives, Elizabeth Porter, in that debate had some pretty harsh words for young people, teens, who are calling for political action. Let's take a listen.
We've been told that we need to listen to the children. I do what the children ask. Are there any children on this floor? Are there any children making laws? Do we allow the children to tell us that we should pass a law that says no homework? The adults make the laws because we have the age, we have the wisdom, and we have the experience.
And Joshua Douglas, what about that point, the notion that at a certain age, that young people just really aren't equipped or versed enough to cast a vote?
Well, psychological studies disprove that point, Melissa. Psychologists generally think of cognition and what is referred to colloquially as hot cognition and cold cognition. Hot cognition is impulse control, peer pressure situations where you're making a snap judgment. And psychologists say that brains are fully developed for hot cognition not until age 21 or maybe a little bit older. Cold cognition, on the other hand, is reasoned decision-making where you have time to deliberate and think about your options. And psychologists say that brains are developed for cold cognition by age 16. So essentially, voting is a cold cognition activity. It's not the sort of snap judgment type of thing in the heat of the moment, at least. And the brain is no different at age 16 than it is at age 26 or older. So nothing magical happens at age 18 in terms of brain development to make people reasoned voters. And I think, you know, you can just see all of the people who are speaking out, who are poised, who are making reasoned arguments. And, you know, why would we want to deny people who are having a strong voice in our community from and making change? And I think also we need to couple this with improved civics education. I think certainly in this country we need to foster more civic engagement and understanding what's referred to as action civics, where people are not just learning in school sort of the rote separation of powers and three branches of government, but are actually engaged in solving problems. And there are a lot of innovative social studies and civics teachers working on these kinds of efforts to really engage young people. And when that happens, we see a lot of positive progress.
Let's go back to the phones and to Detroit. Tom is calling. Tom, you're on the air.
Hi, Melissa. How are you?
Good. How are you?
There's a couple of quotes that I'm going to mention. From the mouth of babes, and a child shall lead them. You know, in terms of this situation about the guns, some of these kids are sitting around wondering, am I going to be next? And this is kind of like the groundswell for this thing about, you know, them getting registered to vote and, you know, trying to make a difference. And at 16, no, I don't think you should be, you know, I don't think they should be allowed to vote. 18, I don't have a problem with it. But I think with this groundswell, and, you know, like the young man that you had from out in Colorado mm-hmm. on earlier, I wish him all the best in the world in terms of getting, you know, people, kids registered. And I know here in Detroit, what I do is I go down to the election commission, I get me a stack of voters registration, and I take them around to the high schools that are around in my neighborhood, and I give them to them, and I tell them specifically. I said, these are for the students who are going to be 18 before the next vote. All right, so they can, you know, get registered there, and when the vote comes, you know, there. And one more thing, and then I'm going to go.
Okay,
I
sure.
I think that in terms of absentee voting, I believe that regardless of where a kid comes from, if he or she can get an absentee ballot and send it back in, I think that vote should be counted. I don't think that the first time that they vote that they should necessarily have to have a physical presence in their precinct to vote.
Okay, Tom, thank you so much for your call. We're sort of addressing there the issue of whether students should be allowed or young people should be allowed to vote at 16, not 18. Let's go back in time a little bit to March of 2015 when young people in San Francisco were pushing for a ballot measure that would lower the city's voting age to 16.
E-O-T-E, 16 for democracy.
Oftentimes you're 18, you think about going to college, you think about work, and so voting right then is not a priority.
Well, that ballot measure in San Francisco did fail, but the nearby city of Berkeley did pass a measure. It allows voters who are 16 and up to vote in local school board elections. And I should mention that the District of Columbia, Washington, D.C., also before the city council, has a measure that looks like it will pass. It has the mayor's support to lower the voting age for D.C. elections to 16 and also for national elections. So for the presidency, what about that? Joshua Douglas, are you seeing any broader movement for a measure like that, or is this just limited to enclaves that may be seen as pretty safely Democratic?
I think there is a broader measure in that it's starting in certain places and then it'll become normalized and then become more widespread. There's actually a bill in New York State that's looking at lowering the voting age in statewide elections to 17. The San Francisco example is interesting. When the polls were – when they did some polling initially, they found that it had only about 30 to 35% support, and yet the measure lost 52 to 48%. So they went from 30 to 35% support to almost winning, and they plan to put it back on the ballot in 2020. D.C., the council member had introduced a bill several years ago to lower the voting age to 16, and it went nowhere. And now this year, he has a majority of the council's support. So I think this is a slow but growing movement. And what I think we'll see is that when places do it and they see, look, it's working pretty well, then more places will jump on board. There's already a handful of cities, as you mentioned, including some places in Maryland that have lowered the voting age to 16. What we've seen is that turnout among 16 and 17-year-olds in those places is actually much higher. I think in Tacoma Park, it was double the turnout from 18 to 21-year-olds. So this voting group is embracing their new ability to vote in local elections, and I think proving that the system can work. They're informed voters, and they're engaged in the community because of this action. It is just at the local level now, but I think we, you know, give it some more years, and we'll see how far it goes.
It does raise interesting questions, though, doesn't it, about different ages that are at which you're allowed to do different things, right? You can drink at 21. You buy cigarettes at 18. Do all of those laws get thrown into question if we lower the voting age to 16? Let's go to the call to the phones again and to Columbia, Missouri. Marley is calling. Marley, you're on the air.
Thank you. And I was just curious, if we are enabling our youth to vote at the age of 16, why don't we allow them to enlist in the military? I personally did myself, and I feel like I earned my right to vote. Thinking back when I was 16, I was a completely different person.
Uh-huh.
I was very volatile and had a series of issues, and I just don't understand how we can allow the youth to change our democracy when they have yet to even live on their own and see how it actually works.
Okay.
It seems like a fallacy to me.
Marley, thank you for calling in. John Della Volpe, you want to address that concern?
Well, I think anytime we identify an age where an individual should begin to vote, it's somewhat arbitrary. But to me, it makes as much sense as any other age to tie it to the time when you're 18 and when you are able to join the military. And most people are beginning to earn some money, pay taxes, et cetera. The concern I would have is if I were advising, 16 and 17-year-olds and others who are engaged in kind of the movement to kind of expand the franchise, is it's been since 18 to 24-year-olds, since they had the right to – since 18-year-olds had the right to vote in 1972, only – at one election, and that presidential election, did they vote in did a majority turn out to vote?
Which was that?
In the 1972 election, among 18 to 24 years. Uh-huh. Every election since then, we've seen turnout in the mid-30s to the mid-40s. So I'd like to see a greater level of participation among youngest voters first before we, I think, expand the franchise on a national basis.
Lots of fascinating issues that this raises, and I want to come back after the break to think about a little bit about what other countries do. Are we an anomaly, or are other countries pretty much in line with how where we draw the line on voting age? We are discussing youth voter participation and the possibility of lowering the voting age to 16, whether that is a good idea or not. You can join the conversation. Should 16-year-olds be allowed to vote in local elections, state elections? How about national elections? I'm Melissa Block, and this is On Point.
Are you funnier than Fallon? More amusing than Aziz? More clever than Click and Clack? Well, if you've got an idea that'll make people laugh, enter WBUR's Next Great Show contest for a chance to get your show on the air. To find out more, go to WBUR.org/nextgreatshow.
This is On Point. I'm Melissa Block. We're discussing youth voter participation after the March for Our Lives and the possibility of lowering the voting age to 16. You can join the conversation. Are 16-year-olds mature enough to vote? How would it change the political landscape if they could? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guests are John Della Volpe. He is director of polling at the Harvard Kennedy School Institute of Politics, and also Joshua Douglas, law professor at the University of Kentucky. And let me start with that question I raised before the break about what other countries do in terms of voting age. John or Joshua, who'd like to take that on?
Well, I can mention just a couple examples, Melissa.
Okay.
There are a handful of places of democracies that have a lower voting age to 16, and it's fairly routine. I actually spent two weeks in Scotland last year. They're studying how and why Scotland lowered the voting age to 16. It started with the referendum vote, where they lowered the voting age and allowed 16 to 17-year-olds to vote in the referendum. And combined with that, high schools worked on civics education, what they call modern studies there, and they actually brought people in to discuss and debate the issue. And youth turned out at a very large number. And then it was so successful that the politicians who were opposed, the conservatives initially, all jumped on board. And it was virtually unanimous when they lowered the voting age to 16 for all elections in Scotland. There's a handful of other places as well, Denmark, Austria, et cetera, that have 16-year-old voting. And pretty much no one bats an eye about it.
Let's go back to the phones. I'm taking a call from Harrison, calling from Oklahoma City. Harrison, what do you have to say?
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't believe that they should raise the voting age to 21, but I do believe this. If they're going to require it for you to be 21 to drink, for you to be 21 to carry a firearm, that means that you don't have the mental capability or responsibility to do either one of those, then you shouldn't be able to change policy on certain things. You know, I don't think you should be mature enough. Now, me, I'm military. I joined the military when I was 18. I moved out when I was 18. I actually had a wife and a kid when I was 18.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I was able to bear arms and defend my home, so I wasn't in my house scared. But I thought it was odd that I could go die for my country, but I couldn't have a beer. You know, which I got over that. I mean, I'm 35 years old now, but, for a young person that's moving out, especially my daughter, I have a daughter, she's 16, getting ready to be 17, she'll be joining. Mm-hmm. If she was to move out, I would want her to have a firearm in her home.
Uh-huh. But you don't think she would be wise enough or ready to vote at the age she is now?
No, I think at 18 she would, but not at 16.
Okay. Harrison, thanks for you. Got it. Thank Harrison, thank you for your call. And we have a countervailing view, I believe, from Suzanne, who's calling from Grinnell, Iowa. Suzanne?
Oh, yeah. Hi. Thank you. I guess I think that it could be very helpful if all the 18-year-olds, or I mean 17-year-olds, if senior year you took a civics class that taught you how to vote and that you register everybody. Right now we choose the time that you register as the time when you disperse and you're hard to track down, and it would be helpful to have somebody bring you through the process, how to assess the facts responsibly, et cetera, et cetera. And I did teach community college. Mm-hmm. I taught economics, and I saw that that they had different experiences.
And would you think that the voting age should be lowered to 16?
I think 17.
17. You're going right in the middle.
Yes, I think, and maybe
that's the Goldilocks formula right there, right?
And 17.
Sorry?
What?
I said the Goldilocks formula. Just
well,
right.
The thing is, if you had 16, maybe for local elections, but I think for nationally, 17, because you have that senior year and you're being primed to go out into the world and be a productive citizen. I mean, not that people aren't working at 17, but I guess I feel like we are blowing out of proportion that these people are going to be sole makers of the new laws. They're going to be one demographic among many, mm-hmm. and I think their voice needs to be heard, because if you give, it's a little bit like the those laws that say you have to be straight and clean before you get housing, and they're learning that you can, if you get housing first, then you are able to do all those other things. And I think it's the same way. If you give people the vote now, they'll do it.
Suzanne, sorry, I think we lost you there. Sorry, Suzanne, calling from Grinnell, Iowa. Very briefly, John Della Volpe, your prediction for what we'll be seeing in November's midterms in terms of the youth vote?
We're seeing the highest level of youth participation at this stage that we've seen in well over a decade. 37% of young people 18 to 29 say they will, quote, definitely vote in November, which is 14 points higher than we saw in the 2014 midterms, 6 points higher than we saw in the wave election of 2010.
Okay, and we'll have to leave it there. Fascinating conversation. John Della Volpe, Director of Polling at Harvard's Kennedy School Institute of Politics. John, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Joshua Douglas, law professor at the University of Kentucky. Josh, thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Melissa.
And in a moment, what's behind CIA Director Mike Pompeo's surprise meeting in North Korea with leader Kim Jong-un? This is On Point. I'm Melissa Block, and this is On Point. We're learning that CIA Director Mike Pompeo traveled to North Korea for a secret meeting with the country's leader, Kim Jong-un, in Pyongyang over Easter weekend. Pompeo reportedly did not take any White House or State Department officials with him on the trip. Joining me now to talk about this from Cambridge, Massachusetts, is Catherine Moon. She is an expert on Korea and a professor of Asian Studies and Political Science at Wellesley College. Professor Moon, welcome to On Point. And also joining me is Shane Harris, a national security reporter with The Washington Post. The Post broke this story. Shane, welcome to the program.
Hi, Melissa.
And Shane, let's start with you. Details that you've been learning about just when and where this meeting happened, how long it went, what was discussed?
Well, the details are still a little scarce at this point, but we know that Director Pompeo went over the Easter weekend to North Korea, where he met with Kim Jong-un. And it sounds as though the main issue that he was able to get was some assurances from the North Koreans that they were willing to discuss denuclearization as part of the upcoming summit with President Trump. Officials began telling reporters about a week after that meeting on background that, yes, we have some assurances from the North Koreans that they're open to this. They weren't telling us how they knew that, but it now does appear that Director Pompeo got those assurances when he was in North Korea.
You would wonder what the point of a summit would be if denuclearization were not on the table. What, I mean, there are other things to talk about, but that is the big one.
Yeah, well, it's a big one also that that President Trump has said that he wants to discuss. That's sort of the frame that he has set around this meeting. This is what we're here to talk about. He even, in a tweet confirming our report this morning, said that denuclearization will be good for the world and good for North Korea. So I think that the White House was reluctant to sit down and have these talks unless that was on the table. And we should remember, too, these were talks that took many people in the White House by surprise when the president sort of seemed to impromptu agree to them several weeks ago.
Yeah. How unusual is it that this outreach to North Korea went through the intelligence channels, not through diplomatic channels? It was the CIA director going. It was not the embattled Secretary of State, then Secretary of State Rex Tillerson.
Yes, it's quite unusual. And in fact, the outreach from the administration even before this meeting has been handled via the CIA and these intelligence channels. You know, as far as we know, it appears that Pompeo is quite literally in the air going over to North Korea as Rex Tillerson is marking his last day officially as secretary.
Yeah.
And of course, he'd been dismissed a couple of weeks before that. I mean, for all intents and purposes, Mike Pompeo has been acting in a kind of Secretary of State role when it comes to North Korea. And of course, now he will carry that portfolio over if he's confirmed for that position.
Well, let's talk about that, because in Mike Pompeo's confirmation hearings before the Senate, this did not come up. This was a secret meeting, a secret level of outreach. We've heard from Senator Robert Menendez saying, "I don't expect diplomacy to be negotiated out in the open, but I do expect for someone who was nominated to be Secretary of State, when he speaks with committee leadership and is asked specific questions about North Korea, Senator Menendez says, expects him to share some insights about such a visit. Even in my private conversations with him, he did not tell me about his visit to North Korea." How much of a concern do you figure that might be among the senators considering his nomination?
I think Senator Menendez reflects, you know, generally there's a sense of, I think people are a bit put out that they weren't told, but this does raise the question of, how are we managing this relationship with North Korea? Are we doing it in some kind of clandestine fashion that the people and that the committees overseeing foreign policy don't have any input on? I imagine that there will also be a feeling that, well, we have now an opening. Mike Pompeo is about to be Secretary of State, so I
don't think he's confirmed.
Yeah, if he's confirmed, right. And so I don't know that this will necessarily hurt his chances, but I would imagine that many senators are quite put out about this. I mean, our understanding is the Foreign Relations Committee, which had been considering his nomination, was not told of this. I think they were caught by surprise. Senators, I think, generally don't like to be caught by surprise
yeah.
on issues of this.
An understatement, yeah.
Right. So, I mean, but I think many of them will now have more questions for him about how he sees the North Korea relationship, considering that he sat down face-to-face with the leader of North Korea. And I'm sure many of them would have liked to have known that when Mike Pompeo had his confirmation hearing.
Let's bring Catherine Moon into the conversation, professor at Wellesley College. Professor Moon, what would you expect? We talked about denuclearization being among the items on the table. What else would, if a summit does come to bear, come to pass, what would be under discussion? Whoa. Professor Moon, I'm sorry, your line is breaking up. If you can move to a place that might be a little more clear, that would be great.
Sorry, denuclearization.
And I'm sorry, we are going to have a really hard time hearing you. If you can possibly move, that would be helpful. And I'm going to turn back to Shane Harris while we try to get a better connection to you. Shane Harris, you've been reporting on this. As I mentioned, the Washington Post broke the story of Mike Pompeo's secret mission to North Korea, meeting with Kim Jong-un. Do we know how long the meeting lasted? You said details are few. Do we know anything more about what else is under discussion that will be, if the summit does happen, under discussion?
Right, we don't, and it's so tantalizing, and even in trying to confirm this, I mean, we were even trying to see if we could find out what plane he took to go to North Korea, which you might imagine the CIA director doesn't announce his travel schedule. But this was something that, from what we understand, was substantive of a discussion enough that it really did give the administration enough assurance that North Korea was serious about denuclearization as a negotiating point, that they were willing willing to then come back and talk about that and confirm that to reporters. So I have to just imagine at the outset that that discussion was substantive, must have been fairly wide-ranging. We do understand from a little bit that there was a social kind of visit. I mean, these were two people who were sitting down also and trying to spend time and get to know each other. But in terms of just exactly how long precisely everything that was discussed, those details are still a little bit hazy towards us now, but hopefully will become clearer, you know, especially now that the president has confirmed that meeting happened.
Confirmed in public, but also by Twitter, I believe, yeah?
That's right. Well, he said it on his tweet this morning that it did happen. And yesterday he said that there were, in public he said this, that there had been meetings at very high and extremely high, as he put it, levels, which when my colleagues and I heard that, I think we thought to ourselves, yeah, we know what he's talking about.
Huh. So. Well, there was some confusion at one point of whether he had actually said that he himself had already met with Kim Jong-un. That turned out not to be the case. I think we now have Professor Moon back on the line on a better connection. Catherine Moon, we were talking about what some of the main sticking points are between the United States and North Korea that would be the basis for an upcoming summit. What are some of those?
Well, you started asking me about denuclearization,
right,
and the fact is that denuclearization means different things to North Korea and to the U.S. When we say denuclearization, we mean full denuclearization over a period of time that's verifiable. And for North Koreans, it usually means arms control talks, which means that they will expect the U.S. to offer something in return, if not in terms of nuclear threats that would be reduced, at least some conventional threats that they find particularly noxious to them, which the U.S. will not want to move on because we have an alliance with South Korea as well as Japan, and we provide the security guarantee overall for them. But I think sanctions will certainly be on the table because that's what North Koreans are particularly interested in. And then the U.S. government is in a sticky position because the U.S. has pushed so hard to stiffen the sanctions. There are some sanctions that the U.S. took that are not as serious or important, and it's possible that we may backpedal on the easier portions of the sanctions. But sanctions, of course, the multilateral ones are out of the UN Security Council, so the U.S. alone will not be able to negotiate that.
There's another tantalizing prospect that I wanted to ask you about, which would be that one thing that both parties might be interested in trying to come to an accommodation on would be a formal peace treaty to end the Korean War. Explain how that would work.
Well, as you probably know, yesterday it seemed that South Korea and maybe North Korea were on the brink of announcing some major statement about ending the war and working toward a peace treaty, the inter-Korean side of this.
Mm-hmm.
So far, we have not heard such an announcement, and we know that South Koreans are giving big hints that that will be on the table when President Moon Jae-in of South Korea and Kim Jong-un of North Korea meet next week for their first ever summit. If that were to occur, then rhetorically and in terms of the framing of the inter-Korean problem and the division, that would be a sea change. But a peace process, whether it's inter-Korean or whether it's U.S.-North Korea, and of course with the U.S., we have to involve all of the U.N. Security Council and UN members who were part of the original Korean War, because the peace settlement, there never was one after the Korean War.
So this would not be a bilateral thing that the Koreas could do together or just the United States. And North Korea involves a number of other players as well.
Right. Just one thing, I know we have very little time.
Yeah, very briefly.
I think this trip by Pompeo is interesting because it shows that he and Trump don't have daylight between them. This could not have happened with Tillerson.
Right.
On the other hand, Tillerson set up the process in motion for these kinds of warming up contacts to occur.
Okay, Professor Moon, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. Professor Catherine Moon, professor at Wellesley College, thanks so much. Also, Shane Harris with The Washington Post. Shane, we look forward to more of your reporting. I'm Alyssa Block, and this is On Point. Thank you.